Hey everybody, welcome back. This is Jason Herbert, your host and creator of Historians of the Movies, a weekly podcast about history and film and the history of film and history and God knows what else. And this week we've got an awesome conversation for you. We've got Kate Jewell. She just wrote a brand new book called Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. Now, Kate is a professor of history at Fitchburg State University up in Massachusetts. And the movie we decided to pair her work with is John Cusack's High Fidelity. If you know this film, you know it's an awesome film. It's got a great performance by Cusack in this really kind of multidimensional role. It's got a really zany appearance by Jack Black, who probably steals the movie. And it has one of the great, arguably top five soundtracks of all time. This is such a fun movie, and this is such a great conversation that Kate and I get into. I think you're really going to enjoy this. So I'm going to keep this introduction short. Guys, sit back and relax, because High Fidelity is next on Historians of the Movies podcast. Hey, Kate Jewell, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Jason?
I feel like I've never seen you anymore because it's been like 4 days since I've seen you.
Yeah, I kind of still feel like I'm in Denver.
I also feel like that, only that's because I'm in Colorado right now. I'm in Pueblo, but that's like 2 hours south of Denver, and we're very low. We're like 4,600 feet. We're like 600 feet below Denver. So I'm trying to get people to call it the Delta. But nobody's really taking it. They're like, nah, you're still like a Maya. No, like, I don't know. My humor is falling you short here as it does everywhere else. I'm like,
it's too much of a water reference for such a dry climate.
I know. Well, they have. Okay, so we actually have a river, and maybe that's the problem. We have like a river in Colorado. We have two. We've got the Arkansas and the Platte, and that's
not the Colorado.
Oh shit! Three rivers. You know, I have a PhD in environmental history. You know, you would think that I would know.
I haven't looked at a map recently. Don't quote
me. No, the Colorado. Shit, man. Did you ever listen to the Highwaymen song, The Highwaymen, with like Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson and Johnny Cash, who is referenced in this film? Mm-hmm. Like, Waylon Jennings dies in the Colorado River when they're building. I'm a damn builder, cross the river deep and wide, right? Or that one. Like, he's like, I don't know.
Is that mentioned in Cash by Johnny Cash? Rob's favorite book.
That is such a shitty book. We're going to get into it. My book club read that book last year, and I still haven't heard the last of it because that book was awful. Or is it this year? It was last year. It was just an awful, awful book. But we'll get into that. All right.
Okay.
Now that we've like dispensed with the pleasantries. All right, Kate, you're not actually here. In fact, you're not in Denver. Where are you?
I am in Belmont, Massachusetts.
I thought you'd be in Fitchburg.
No, I do not live in Fitchburg. I live in Belmont, which is just outside of Boston.
So are you commuting?
I commute, yes, out Route 2, beautiful Route 2, to lovely post-industrial Fitchburg, which is basically due north of Worcester in Massachusetts. So it's central Massachusetts, Worcester County, and Route 2 is a lovely little road that goes out there, as long as you don't get run over by a pickup truck.
Wait, they have pickup trucks in Massachusetts?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
This offends my southern sensibilities. The idea that there's a hillbilly Massachusettsian. What is a person from Massachusetts? Because you're from Massachusetts, right?
Sort of. Yes.
Okay. What does native Massachusetts call? Is it Massachute? Like, how do people call themselves it? Like, I'm a Kentuckian.
Massachusetts? Well, do you want to know what people call us? So I grew up in Vermont. My mom is from Massachusetts, sort of. But in Vermont, they call people from Massachusetts massholes.
Right, yeah.
So I embrace my massholeness. It's fine.
Okay. And what are the native Massachusetts? Are they just massers? Like what do they do?
That's a good question.
I don't know what they do. Because like Maine is Mainers, right? Mm-hmm. And New Yorkers are New Yorkers. I don't know. All right, so you're from Vermont, which to everyone else is like Western Massachusetts. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, my husband's from Iowa, and he doesn't believe that New England should be six states, and it is probably the source of the greatest conflict in our marriage because people think Vermont and New Hampshire are the same thing. They're like flipped.
Yeah, absolutely.
Totally different states. Totally different. Green mountains, white mountains. It's a whole thing. It's a whole thing.
This is like saying Minnesota and Wisconsin are two different places because they're the exact same place. It's the same settlers. It's the same region, the same topography. The only difference is like Wisconsin got all heavy Republican and wrecked their economy and everything sucks over there. And then Minnesota's like, hey, how about we feed children? So, you know, there's that.
Land of the progressives, though. Bob La Follette.
Can we argue that Iowa should not be a state?
I don't know. They have 99 counties. Like, they're...
Have you been to Iowa? Like, did he bring you back to think, like feed the family, to meet the family?
Or yeah, did you feed he's from Cedar well? Rapids, so...
I don't know where that is. Where's Cedar Rapids?
It's in the middle of the eastern third.
I want you to say, like, it's in the middle of Iowa, which would be in the middle of the country. It's like, Cedar Rapids is America. Like, yeah, I've been to Iowa City. Have you been to Iowa City?
Yes, yes. It's like 45 minutes, half an hour from Iowa City.
Okay, because I love the University of Iowa. That's like a college beautiful town. Oh my God, that is a gorgeous. So one of my best friends is from Iowa, and he's always like, he goes back and forth between Iowa and Columbia as far as his favorite places. And he lives in Florida, which is half equidistant between the two. I don't know why he does these things. Either way, like,
I mean, not like Iowa's, but
I worry every time he goes to Iowa because all I see are these like giant like pork cutlet sandwiches that they make out there.
The food is intense. Best burger I ever had, though, was in Czech Village in Cedar Rapids.
Wait, is there like a Czech population?
The National Czech and Slovak Museum is in Czech Village in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Exactly where I thought it would be.
Yes.
I had no idea that that's where the Czechs settled.
Willa Cather, like My Antonia, the Bohemians. Is like,
are these all Czech people?
Well, she wrote, I don't think Willa Cather is Czech, but.
I don't. Yeah. I mean, I went to the Czech Republic last year. I loved it. I can't wait to go back. I want to go next year.
Like, yeah, you need to go to Cedar Rapids in between.
All right. Let me ask you this: because people are like, "Are you guys? Is this a Field of Dreams talk? Is that what we're doing? Are we spending our time in Iowa?" Actually, that's a different podcast we're going to do at some point in time, and like with like other men, and then we're all going to talk about our fathers and then cry a lot. It's called Therapy with Historians of the Movies. It's gonna be it's gonna be like a new thing that we do, and maybe. Okay, I was talking earlier today. This film, God, John Cusack is utterly unlikable in this movie. Am I wrong or what?
He comes around in the end.
He's got some. I mean, okay, we'll get him to say. Let's go back to you for a second. Who is totally likable right now? You're at Fitchburg State. What are you doing over there? Like, what do you teach over there?
So I teach 20th century U.S. history, except I also teach, we are a multidisciplinary department. And so I also cover cross-list courses in political science and economics. So I also teach U.S. economic history, and I teach the American presidency right now as well, which is cross-listed with political science. But I mostly focus on political and cultural history in my classes and economic history as well. I do all the things 20th century. So I'm very lucky in that I don't have to go pre-Civil War. I can if I want to, and I do when I do U.S. economic history. But for the most part, I get to talk about the recent United States.
Yeah, I'm totally excited about this too, because your book, when I heard it was coming out, of course, we were already friends when I heard it was coming out, and it's such an interesting idea. This idea of a book about the history of college radio, and which I know nothing about because I went to college in 95 through 97 while I flunked out and then came back later. And I feel like I missed the heyday of college radio. And I'm like, who writes the history of college? And this isn't your first book, right? Like, what was your first book about?
Okay. They don't sound like they're related. To me, they totally are. My friend Ellie Shermer gave me this lovely phrase that she heard, which is that your first book is about your parents and your second book is about you. And I am a 1,000% fits me. So my first book is about this nasty little organization called the Southern States Industrial Council, which was an anti-New Deal Southern economic association. And they're primarily a political lobbying group that fought the way that the New Deal was being implemented. At first, they were not New Deal, anti-New Deal. But then over time, they very quickly became very anti-New Deal, and in particular related to labor. So my family, my dad's family, is from Lebanon, Tennessee, which is where the founder of that organization was from. And so my grandfather actually was a mill worker at the mill, the woolen mill, that John Edgerton, who founded the Southern States Industrial Council, he was also the president of the National Association of Manufacturers in the 1920s, and virulently anti-labor. My grandfather worked in the woolen mill. And my great aunt worked in the front office of the woolen mill, and my dad worked hauling bales of wool in summers in the warehouse when he was in college. So various permutations of people in my family worked for them. And so I was always interested in how they used and shaped the concept of Southern identity to achieve political ends. And that it was all about kind of crafting this idea of the South and its economy that they were trying to inject kind of into public policy and into educational materials and to prevent people from joining unions, basically. And so it's this, you know, kind of question about the intersection of business and politics and culture that interests me as a historian. And these people who are involved in shaping identities, national, regional identities, and also gatekeeping belonging to those. And so those are kind of the underlying questions that I'm interested in as a historian. But college radio is obviously something that I did when I was in college. And we can talk about how we are both Xennials, because I think this will apply very much to discussing High Fidelity. But I was there from 97 to 2001.
Oh my God, I'm older than you. Oh, I already knew that. But wait, no, it's part of because my memory is fading already. That's what's happening. I'm looking forward to dementia. Cool. Everything will always be new. And someone listening right now is cursing me because someone in their family is going through it. So that's nice. But go on. All right. I'm sorry.
So I was there during a particularly embattled moment for college radio because it was post Telecommunications Act of 1996. And so the corporatization had really taken hold or was starting to take hold in kind of alternative rock radio. And so college radio considered itself very much this antithesis to that. The thing, that idea of a golden age, though, mm-hmm. it's one that's forged through conflict, as are they all, right? That it's golden agedness mm-hmm. was actually really shaped by it's the larger kind of cultural and political conflicts that college radio found itself and the people who were involved in it found themselves embroiled in, and that it was a really important refuge for many people in what we could think of broadly as the culture wars. It was kind of a safe space, if you will. But it was also one of the few places that people could actually gain access to the airwaves. And so with commercial media narrowing and it being harder for people to find places to hear the stuff that they wanted on radio broadly or on television broadly, as narrowcasting took hold, college radio becomes this really important place for people to find the sounds and news and information and voices that they felt represented them or that they could connect with.
I want to go back for a quick second here, and I actually want to define what college radio is. And specifically, like, when you think about what college radio, like, I think a lot of us have this idea of late night, some person in a DJ booth at whatever state university kind of broadcasting. Like, where does college radio come from? How do you define college radio? And this might sound like a really odd question, but I think maybe just to understand, like, what's college radio and why is it different than conventional radio?
So it's one of these really slippery terms because it does depend on what you mean. And so we tend to think of college radio as this thing that had a very particular role in the music industry in the 80s and 90s and launching bands like REM and Nirvana to commercial success. And it was sort of the place you would go for the newest, most exciting, challenging music. And that's all true. College radio absolutely did those things. But it has always been a very diverse place. It's done many different things, served many different constituents, served many different pedagogical functions. So for me, the college radio that I was investigating was that kind of nostalgic concept of its role in the music industry, because the reason I wrote the book is in 2011, my alma mater, Vanderbilt University, sold our radio signal. And it was one of a number. There's a huge spate of them that were sold around the same time, or were otherwise transformed in some way. And there was a sense that something had been lost, that this thing that we all loved, you know,
it was ours
that, you know, defined a kind of generational experience, now because of technological change, was going away. And so I started looking around to think like, okay, well, what is this thing? Where did it come from? What is it? What defines it? And why was it so valuable? And there had been really no national study of college radio written. So I was like, well, I can do that. And the book project was just kind of took off from there as I started investigating that. So for my purposes, I'm thinking about college radio as particularly student-run radio. Because, of course, in Boston, we have WBUR, which is a big nationally syndicated programs for National Public Radio come out of that station. Its license is owned by Boston University. It used to be student and community run until John Silber came on as chancellor in the 1970s. And it morphed into an NPR station, and a great station. It's a wonderful station, but it's not student-run radio. And so for my purposes, I look at those licenses that they usually are held by universities. Sometimes independent organizations will own the license, but it still counts as a student activity. MIT is like that. They're in general nonprofit stations, non-commercial stations, although that also is not always true. Ivy League stations are on the commercial band, and they often sound just like commercial rock radio stations. I actually grew up listening to college radio, but I didn't know it. I had no idea what college radio was when I got to college. Wow. Because I was from Vermont, and there's mountains there, people might have heard. And so radio is kind of a difficult thing in Vermont. You can lose the signals very quickly, but one of the stations that I could pick up was the Dartmouth station, which was basically a commercial rock station, and it was WFRD. So it kind of runs the gamut in terms of license ownership, in terms of the programming. But for me, I'm interested in those student-run stations, particularly as they grew on FM in the 1960s and the 1970s. It became two book projects while I was writing it, because book one, we'll call it, is the 60s and the 70s as these stations were coming onto FM, and they kind of constructed this idea of alternative radio, not related to any musical genre. But this second book that is out first picks up in that alternative moment in the 1970s and looks at college radio becoming incorporated into the music industry and as a site of culture wars and caught up in the transformations of higher education since the 1970s.
You talk about college radio and getting caught up in the culture wars and things like that. And you're talking about the 1970s, and there's this thing just kind of looming around, I think, for those of us zennials who have lived through that moment, looming as we move forward through history. One thing things neat about being a historian is, like, we know what comes next, right? Like, we see this thing, and when people are caught up in the moment in the 1970s, they don't know what's coming about to hit in 1980, 81, 82. And of course, I'm talking about MTV. And I'm kind of curious, just thinking about that, you know, you and I both grew up in the MTV era. I can still hear and see the MTV commercials in my mind. David Bowie specifically, right? Who I think was probably a darling of college radio himself. I know he got a lot of airplay, but was there an influence of of college radio onto the creation of MTV? Because MTV just kind of seems like it took over the world in the 80s. I'm kind of wondering if there was a response, if that was responding to what I was hearing on college radio, or if people were transitioning from college radio into MTV. What's that relationship?
So I wouldn't draw any kind of causal line between college radio and MTV, but I think they certainly were both part of developments in the music industry in the early 1980s. Because so in the late 1970s, there's this economic recession and the music industry's business model is really transforming. And radio, commercial radio, is transforming. It's developed what we would think of as sort of like the modern formats of AOR, album-oriented radio, which is sort of like rock radio, mainstream rock, country, and sort of what will become kind of the urban format as well. And college radio is part of that. But the music industry is going through a doldrums in terms of its sales. It's really focused on this kind of superstars, like promoting like the biggest acts and anything that can really kind of cut across lots of different audiences. And disco's on the decline as well. So there's all kinds of troubles happening in the music industry. MTV is happening in the midst of all of that, as is college radio's transformation into, I don't know how much backstory to give here, but basically a lot of college stations are, a lot of college stations are increasing their wattage around this time because of some FCC changes in licensing, forced kind of by NPR. NPR is sort of the bad guy in my book.
What? Are you kidding me? NPR is the bad guy?
NPR is the bad guy.
Oh my God. This is like the heel turn nobody saw coming. Oh, wow. Okay, go on.
Yeah. So it has an ironic outcome because basically NPR is trying to get rid of these little 10 watt signals that would get in the way of these big, you know, 100,000 watt stations that could reach really far. And instead of going out of business or going back to a carrier currentization, a lot of these college radio stations decide to increase their wattage, which makes them more valuable as a part of the music industry. And so MTV is kind of in the mix of this as well. And so people will know maybe the backstory of MTV when it first comes on, that a lot of the music that it played was very white. College radio is also very white. And so they share some things in common in terms of their programming and who is being served. College radio had more opportunities for other people to get involved. And that was a big point of contention. That I go into a lot in the book of, you know, basically people, the Black campus movement, the Latinx students movement, Chicano movement, really looking at these stations as the places that needed to reflect them and their communities as well. But a lot of the music played on MTV at first was new wave from England, because that's who was making music videos. And so, and a lot of that music was really strongly associated with college radio, because that was the only place where you could hear a lot of the new they called it progressive music at the time, which is very confusing because it's not prog rock. It's progressive music, which then becomes new wave. And then there's sort of a commercial flowering of new wave records that are kind of born pop hits. And so college radio and MTV have some overlap in terms of programming, but MTV really quickly becomes like mainstream pop and kind of an anathema to what college radio was about. They were about finding the new stuff that could potentially end up on MTV. And a lot of college DJs reference in the 1980s, you know, they knew the second that something had been played on MTV, because all of a sudden the request lines would blow up with this song. And they're like, well, we don't need to play that because it's clearly already made it to MTV. And so that's like not our job anymore. We're supposed to play the new stuff and let MTV kind of do the teeny bopper thing, they might have said. Definitely said that.
This seems like a real class war between the college, between like this sense of identity and like whose turf is on where, like who can play what based on, you know, this is almost like the Southern like identity thing, where it's so much of it's wrapped up in who we are not versus who we actually are, or things like that. Like, mm-hmm. I had no idea. Like, I would have imagined that if MTV were playing something, and I'm thinking, you know, Video Killed the Radio Star, that of course college radios would want to play that to their audience. But that's not the case.
No. And, well, it's more complicated. Because Ooh. It's not that college radio was completely devoid of any kind of major label or commercial hit. It's more that, and sort of that kind of indie only idea is much more of a myth than of reality. What it was is that there was just a very different kind of programming ethos at these stations where individual DJs had more control over what they played and to curate their shows. And they also had a lot of specialty shows that served genres, musical genres, and news and information and religious programming that you couldn't find on mainstream radio, commercial radio. And so having that block schedule is a key feature. Not every college radio station used block scheduling. Some did use more commercial formats, which we would think of as day parting. So you think of like morning drive time. So you identify the blocks of the day based on like kind of who the listeners are and what they're doing, as opposed to a block schedule where it's, you know, you have the noise show from 12 to 1 and then the reggae hour from 1 to 4 and then, or 1 to 3. And
it's a know, long hour.
Yeah, long hours. But you know what I mean? Like right, the bluegrass, jazz at night, and you know, you might have like kind of your general indie rock shows and hip hop shows kind of sprinkled throughout. And everybody might pull from the same bin of new releases. But there might be different programming requirements about how many new releases you should play, or how many they call them oldies you could play, how many jazz records you might have to incorporate into your set. That was a rule on my station that you had to incorporate jazz and a world music at some point, even if you had an indie rock show.
Who's making these calls? Because I'm kind of wondering, like, what's getting played on? I imagine in my head, college radio sounds a lot like REM in like 1980, but in Texas A&M, is their station, are they playing country over there? Are they playing like proto George Strait? What's going on here?
they might have. This is the funny thing. If you look at college radio top playlists up until about 1981, it looks a lot like AOR. They're playing Styx. They're playing Dire Straits. They're playing Led Zeppelin. And then they also have new wave, and there's some big battles over like between sort of the people who want to play AOR, you know, the latest Rush album, but maybe they get it first and maybe they play cuts from that album that the commercial station won't. So you can hear like deeper cuts. You can hear the newer singles. So they were still focused on new music. They might feature local bands more. And a lot of those proponents squared off against the new waivers. The thing is, both of them were on major labels for the most part. That there were very few independent labels that were in rotation. And so it was a kind of genre battle. Disco is even in the mix in some stations, believe it or not.
Really? All right. Yeah, I can see that. I don't think disco deserves like the bad rap it still has like 50 years later. Like I feel like there were some bangers.
No, disco's great. But really what these stations are focused on is this idea of being educational. We are educational radio. And so that kind of becomes the thread that allows them to kind of carve out this place within the music industry. So it's really paradoxical because on the one hand, they're saying our educational role is to play stuff that's hasn't become popular, that to educate audiences about the other types of music that might be out there. But it is that very kind of educational function that makes these stations so valuable to the music industry because they're testing product, new product, and kind of doing some early audience research for them. And they would, to get record service, they would really encourage stations to track sales at local record stores, independent record stores, to see what listeners were coming in and trying to buy that they had heard on the radio station. So by around 1981, you know, so in the late 70s, major labels were slashing college radio promotion. That was getting cut in midst that economic downturn. By 81, 82, 83, they are really starting to identify ways to promote records specifically to college radio stations. It's still pretty cheap to do that in terms of the payoff that they might have gotten in terms of the data, but they were definitely writing to the tip sheet that collected college radio charts as CMJ. And you start to see this dialogue section in CMJ become really about these record labels and their promoters trying to get college music managers. And these are, you know, the people making these decisions are students primarily. They might have a professional manager who runs the station, but none of these stations are big enough to be, you know, Corporation for Public Broadcasting funded public radio stations. So to be a CPB funded station, you have to have 5 full-time staffers. Almost no station had any kind of staff to that level. They might have 1, maybe 2 paid staff. And primarily they function as student activities where students can make those decisions, those programming decisions.
I want to know about the personalities who are running these stations. And because you see them pop up, and certainly in the case of Rob in this film here, he's a former college DJ. We see them in Singles. Steve, the protagonist there, in Cameron Crowe's Singles, he's there. We also see it in Old School. Will Ferrell ends up as a college DJ, like at the very end. Like, so we're painted as these, in film, from the limited experience I've seen of college DJs, we get this idea of these young white guys, mm-hmm. kind of hip.
But also really obnoxious, right?
Well, certainly in the case of this film. So I want to like use this, and we'll transition to Rob here in a second. But yeah, snobby. As far as their musicals, oh, super elitist, right? But don't you just get the elitism in any super niche thing, whether you are into college music or if you're a Star Trek person or anything like that? It's like you hold on to this piece of who you are and then cast rain down judgment upon others who do not meet your standards and criteria, which we see very much in this film.
So I wrote down the quote.
Oh, okay.
I wrote down the quote from the movie, which is, I forget which person it was who comes into, oh, it was the friend talking to them after they basically not let this one guy buy a record because he wasn't cool enough to be in the club. He says, "You're a bunch of unappreciated scholars who know more than everybody, so you shit all over them." Sad, really.
Boy, if it doesn't hit close to home, not only in the college DJ, but the college professor. There's a lot of us listening to that going, ooh.
Yeah.
That feels, it's a little close to home, but
right. It is a sort of position of insecurity. Even though you know so much, there is also, you know, the reason that these characters resonate so much as a certain type is because they are so insecure in the way that they leverage their knowledge over others to kind of have this sense of like that they have something that makes them valuable, I guess. And that, you know, gives them some kind of status that they otherwise wouldn't have because, you know, there's kind of like nerdy weirdos who like are really into this one thing, and their knowledge gives them status. But anybody who has, you know, engaged in this like mission of higher education knows that, you know, somebody who's truly educated doesn't know everything. They know how much they don't know.
Sure. Absolutely.
Right. So like that is the sort of status of it's like, oh, I don't know anything. Like I'm so insecure about it. You know, I've studied, I've read, I've done all these things, but you know, I know enough to know what I don't know. And I think that kind of insecurity is very much a part of that kind of mindset of somebody who's kind of steeped in pop culture, which, you know, is a very sort of Gen X kind of identity or projected identity.
This is a pop culture podcast run by the tail end of Gen X. And by the way, who I am, because I'm born in 77, I'm constantly worried that I'm not Gen X enough.
Oh yes.
do we do the Zennial thing now, or do we wait on that? Because I do want to come back.
I think the Zennial thing is foundational to this conversation.
Okay, let's go for it. You want to talk about Zennial and the idea of what a Zennial is and how this relates to this movie?
So basically, the Carter babies.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Mom.
And, yeah, and so you know, there was that meme or the activity that went around Twitter a while ago where it was describe when you were born without using any dates. And so I can get right down to my exact date of birth because I was born between Disco Demolition Night and Carter's Malaise Speech, which is July 13th, 1979 and July 15th, 1979. Born July 14th on Bastille Day. But the two kind of, you know, iconic things that define the Zennial experience, economic downturn and malaise. And the sense that pop culture had kind of reached its nadir, I guess, was the low point. Is that the low point? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's zenith and nadir. And those are two words that for smart people that I don't typically use. So thank you for that.
And yeah. And so pop culture becomes this place where Americans battle over national identity and national culture, that pop culture becomes a key site of culture wars, and which are these big, much bigger questions than just what's playing on the radio and what's the content of the songs, right? What's like, you know, titillating or filthy or naughty or occult in the song, right? It goes way beyond any kind of content. It's these bigger questions about the kinds of investment in institutions and processes of democracy that bring the nation together, right? The institutions and processes that allow the nation to function politically and also to have conversations over, you know, what our culture is and what pluralism actually looks like. And whose voices are included, like those are the bigger stakes of the culture wars. And by the 1970s, a lot of those conversations are really shifting into the realm of these spaces like college radio stations, right? That's where ordinary Americans are able to advocate and actually have a say in media and say, like, you know, I want this song, I want that show, bring that show back. That one, the African Vibration show, was like so important to my family. The polka music show on Saturday mornings is like when we tap into our Polish heritage and identity and make pancakes with each other. And they're actually able to influence what goes out over the airways that is shaping a sense of community. And that all goes back to the types of institutions that are supporting that type of media. And those get to policy decisions, those get to regulatory decisions and funding decisions of, you know, when we talk about defunding higher ed, you know, it goes way beyond just, are people going to be educated for the workplace? It's, are we going to be supporting knowledge and cultural creation and community development that reflect the whole nation? So Zennials are important.
All right. So our main character here is a darling of Gen X. And I remember because Cusack's born in 66, so it puts him about 11 years older than I am. I remember, like, as a kid watching him, he was in high school when I was in middle schoolish, right? Like, he was kind of just beyond where I was. Or at least his films were in high school, set in high school. He was probably like 21, 22 or whatever, right? And I see him in all these things, Better Off Dead, Say Anything, so forth. So we see this real icon of Gen X-dom in this role. And getting this movie, we see Rob Gordon, his character, he's lamenting over the loss of his girlfriend just right off the top five breakups. Doesn't even list his girlfriend, Laura, because he's trying to deal with this. And this top five thing becomes like a whole thing. And I remember watching it then. And I remember when I was younger thinking, if John Cusack is in a movie, this movie is cool. Right. I remember always thinking that no matter what, he had this thing about him that I liked. I always gravitated to John Cusack. And watching this movie, I thought for the very first time, this guy's a dick. John Cusack is a self-absorbed, mega he's just an absolute prick in this film. Is he not? I mean, what's your take on him in this movie? Like, we're coming to, like, we both like this movie, but why do we like this movie? Because we got a guy we don't like at all to start with this film.
Well, and I think that's where the Xenial thing comes in, because the, you know, we're the group of young Gen Xers. We're not quite millennials.
Right.
We're not quite Gen X.
We don't quite feel like we fit in either.
No, because they were the older brothers and sisters. They were the people we were looking up to.
The cool kids.
The cool kids who had that certain, you know, je ne sais quoi, you know, and certain style and certain types of experiences just ahead of us. They experienced the 80s as their coming of age, whereas we were really coming of age in the 90s. And so we were kind of watching all that, and the 80s were so, you know, had those particular styles associated with them and types of humor and kind of coolness that the 90s did not have.
Right.
And so I think it's really hard to, in this movie, to separate realizing that your idols are very flawed and maybe that ennui and that coolness that I looked up to as an adolescent and a teenager, maybe that was kind of the wrong thing to look up to. I mean, and John Cusack was, we will go down this rabbit hole, was so huge for me and continues to be very, it's a whole long story. You know, I remember watching him in 16 Candles, highly problematic film. But that was like my favorite movie. And the Nerds, I loved them. And I thought he was so cute. I was like, what's him? And I remember watching the credits to figure out who he was. And then realizing the girl, I thought, there's another Cusack. That must be his sister. Like figuring it out. And like, you know, because there was no
John
internet.
John Jones, yeah.
Yeah. Like
I used to love watching the credits for that. I used to do that all the time.
like figuring out that they were siblings and like watching the other stuff. And, you know, even though he was like the nerd, I was like, oh, he's so cute. And then, of course, I discovered Say Anything and it was all over. He was my number one teenage crush. Like,
he's really like the icon for that kind of awkward, not conventionally handsome, not a bad looking guy in any shape. But not the conventionally James Dean rugged, handsome guy. Awkward, but smart.
Yeah.
Kind of gets himself in brooding, trouble.
Right? Not brooding in the, you know, if they like, what's his name? Like Stephen Dorff or River Phoenix or somebody like that.
Yeah, he's kind of cast aside. He's just like this kind of guy over here. The guys like me found very relatable to, because we were like, oh, he's one of us. Mm-hmm. And we had yet to like find our like nerd moment in time. Like now it's like, awesome. I got Star Wars stuff everywhere. I'm like, what's up, ladies? You want to talk about TIE fighters? It's great. But we weren't there yet.
Right.
And this guy was different. And then, okay. And then we see this, he continues on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and we could talk, you know, sort of the Molly Ringwald character was certainly somebody, you know, the series of characters that she played were always very relatable to me. Somebody who's always kind of like on the outside. And he was sort of like the male version of that, of, you know, somebody who's sort of, you know, not the coolest, but, you know, the person who is like your friends. And I thought he was just like dreamy, like, oh my God, such a huge crush. So I think his unlikability in this film, like it cut a couple of different ways for me, because on the one hand, like, ooh, like questioning all my idols and my role models, but also
he's a smoker in this film, Kate.
Also smoking. Okay. But also I now at this point, I am in college. I am at a college radio station. My future husband works at a used record store in Nashville.
God. Oh, I know the store. Which one?
The Great Escape in Nashville.
Yep. I've been there like a billion times.
Yes, he started there the summer of 2000. So like as this is coming out.
Oh my God, I was shopping there in 2000.
He probably sold you a Playboy. No, did you buy a Playboy?
He dealt with the Playboys. Great Escape had vinyl records and like Star Wars toys and like
yeah.
They had like action figures. This was like in the heyday of people like they didn't know, like, yeah, I'm fair. Just everybody be quiet. I'm cool. I used to go there.
He worked there for a year because he had to take a super semester after he missed a couple of classes. So he stuck around for summer classes after he graduated in 2000. I was class 2001. So I was still in college. And so he stuck around for me for a year.
After. I'm really praying that like he rung me up for something. And then like 23 years later, I hung out with his wife in Denver.
You could ask him.
Do you remember Jason?
Do you remember this guy? Does he look familiar?
He didn't have a beard then. He was thinner.
22 years ago.
Not talking about years. All right, keep going. All right, cue Zach.
Okay. So part of the deal with this movie was like I was so in the thick of that world. Mm-hmm. And so I loved this movie so much and could almost set aside some of the negative aspects of the character because I was like, holy crap, there's a movie about my world.
Yeah.
Like I know these people. I know Barry. I know Dick.
Yeah.
Like I can name the guy at my radio station, Ewatts, looked exactly like Jack Black. Exactly like Jack Black. And he was the same like music, like encyclopedia. It was so weird watching this movie that for a long, and I mean, right down to the Ladybug Transistor poster on the edge of his record stacks. I was like, I had that album.
Is that where this film really succeeds? Is that it absolutely nails what a record shop looks like. You can almost smell the place as you walk in. And then like you're saying, Barry and Dick, the two guys, Jack Black, who were working there, and John Cusack's like, they just showed up and kept coming back. And it's so true, right? And it just feels like the exact people, and these are the exact people, right? We're talking about this idea of like this protective defensive mechanism. These are the same kinds of guys who are either in the record store or they're in the Dungeons and Dragons store, or there's a version of these guys at the fishing and hunting, like the guys who are super into this space.
Yeah.
And they will judge you you come in.
Oh, yes.
And based upon whether or not they like you, they will help you.
Yes. I mean, and this gets back to the book because that guy is my inner critic. Like as a writer, like as I'm typing, I'm like picturing. And
you have Jack Black go boom, da, bah, bah, in the background. Yeah.
And there is a particular historian who, this will be a little Easter egg for your listeners to go and find in the book. There is a historian who I mention in the introduction of my book, who his face is kind of my inner critic. I'm sure he's a lovely person. Like I've never actually met him one-on-one, but I've seen him speak enough and he's in a documentary that I watched and he is the embodiment of my inner critic. And he's also this guy, because so it's like on the one hand, this kind of aspirational thing of like, oh, I wish I had that kind of depth of knowledge and passion for something to that extent. And of course I did, but I was always comparing it against this kind of idealized version. It was usually a man. There are very few images of women who are like this. And if there were, they were usually very unlikable. And so it was kind of jarring to see that embodied on the screen in this particular way.
Oh, actually, this brings me back to a quick question about the DJs. I tend to think about these DJs as white men. Were there many women? Were there non-binary folks? Mm-hmm. Or was this a kind of a man's world?
Yeah, there were a lot of women, people of color, LGBTQ. So college radio is a really important place, especially in the 1970s, for gay programming, gay and lesbian programming. I write about in Nashville at my own station, DJ Ron, who is still a DJ. He lives in Chicago, speaking of high fidelity. And he still DJs on the weekends. And he had a show starting in 1993 in the Buckle of the Bible Belt called Out of the Closet Saturday Night Dance. And he featured drag queens. He had outreach. He was basically a link for kids who couldn't talk to their families. He would help get them help. He, was a sort of stand-in crisis hotline for young people. But he had this amazing dance show, and he stayed on even after he graduated and stayed a community DJ for a long time because he was so connected into the community fabric of Nashville. So these stations did have a lot of diversity, but a lot of the sources of tension came over how much of those shows would be relegated to kind of specialty shows. Some people loved that and it was great because it was like, all I want to play is this stuff at my hours to my audience. I got my 2 hours on Friday night. I'm good. Whereas other people saw the relegation of certain sounds to certain hours and not being incorporated into the overall culture of the station as kind of being sidelined. And so this becomes a big point of contention. Sometimes community DJs who were not matriculated at the university or alumni would come in and do shows. Sometimes they felt very sidelined. Sometimes they had a lot of power at the stations and students felt sidelined. It has all sorts of permutations of those power relationships. But basically it's because there's so few places on the radio dial for people to go to have that voice. And there's only 168 hours in a week. And these are the places where you would have those really heated battles over what programming would look like. And, and you've got Barry in the corner with very strong ideas about how this station should sound.
All right. Can we talk about Jack Black in this movie?
Yes.
What are your thoughts on Jack Black in this movie? Where does this fit in the Jack Black pantheon? With Waterworld as a base, because he's in. Did you know he's in Kevin Costner's Waterworld?
No,
he's like one of the. He's like a super tiny extra who gets blown up in an airplane. But okay, so where is this on the Jack Black scale for you?
So this one, and because my kids were huge fans of School of Rock, also Joan Cusack.
Yep.
One of my favorite roles for her. Those two are my favorite, but I haven't seen a lot of the other ones, so I'm very undermovied. Unfortunately, it's kind of a thing. I listen to a lot of music though, but the ferocity with which he plays this role, and I mean, just everything is just like at this like high level hum that is so true to form of that guy. But also just like so iconic, like all of his lines, like everything that he does is, just down to his dance moves to the Walking on Sunshine clip.
When he comes in and Rob is so pissed off and they're so annoyed and it's Monday morning and they're playing Walking on Sunshine at volume 19.
Dick, what's this?
It's the New Balance Sebastian. Do you like it?
Holy shiite! What the fuck is that?
It's the New Balance Sebastian.
It's the record we've been listening to and enjoying, Barry.
Well, that's unfortunate because it sucks ass. Yours, I assume?
And he's so out, and he's dancing. He's doing the dance, and he's doing the shake. And I'd never seen Jack Black on film before. And if you've never seen Jack Black, this is every part of Jack Black you could ever. God, I love
him. Who is this guy? Like, you could never imagine. And I think he goes so extra in this role where he is. You can never imagine Jack Black is not that guy now.
Oh no.
Like it's impossible. I mean, because I think he kind of has a lot of that guy.
Did you ever see The Holiday?
Yes. and he's very sweet.
See, that's the only other version of Jack Black I've seen when he's not dialed to like 11. And I love that movie because I'm like, if Jack Black can get a date with Kate Winslet, maybe maybe Jason Herbert can too. Like, there's hope for me.
And he is very sweet in that film.
He's lovely. I actually love that movie.
But he's very sweet as Barry.
He is. There is a
sweetness there.
Everything he's doing is like actually about supporting the record store, right? Mm-hmm. And just doing it in his own little manic way. But then also standing opposite of Jack Black is Todd Luiso's Dick. We got to talk about him as well. Like, he is the ideological extreme of Jack Black. Because he also exists.
Also know-it-all. Don't you shouldn't stack the records.
Right.
There's a pressure. Yes. Like, you know, gotta explain to the record store owner. There's pressure. The records get smushed. Like.
Right. But he'll sit and talk to you. And it's very quiet. And while Barry's being Barry, he's just kind of over here being polite and maybe a bit just kind of withdrawn. But it's him who gets the girl.
Yeah, he gets Sarah Gilbert.
Yeah, I mean, Rob gets the girl back too, right? But
Rob too. Sorry, but
but I mean, I want to know who Barry marries. With how many people? How many times Barry marry? Does Barry ever get married? Someone's wife's right on Barry, right? Eventually, like someone's out there for Barry.
Maybe. But he's not going to mellow. He's going to have like a nice garage, like set aside in the house for like all his stuff and his hobbies, and he, you know, go out and like bounce off the walls and like do his thing.
The book that this is based on is set in London. They set the film in Chicago. Does Chicago work as a character in this film?
Oh, that's a good question, because Chicago is such a music city. It is everywhere at the, you know, like Chicago can be so much, but it's while also still being Chicago. I had only been.
Whoa, what do you mean being Chicago? Where does Chicago stand on your list of favorite cities? Was that?
It's like the top three.
In this film, we would say top five.
Top five. Sorry,
what are your top three cities?
Boston, obviously.
Boston's right there.
Boston's number one, always. I'm a Boston, New York, Chicago person. Like, what can I say?
No, it's legitimate, except for the part about New York, because I can't stand New York. New York is fine if I can do New York in like 2 days. Other than New York is just too much for me. It's
technically for me, I'm a born New Yorker.
Okay.
Except upstate. Right. I was born in Schenectady.
I gotta go Chicago. I love Chicago. I love Boston. I also love Minneapolis, St. Paul, which I count as one city inside, but it's too close to Chicago. It's like Diet Chicago. It's almost better because Chicago's just so damned big. And Minneapolis, St. Paul is smaller. You get very similar kind of things. So I'm gonna go Chicago, but really, I mean Minneapolis, St. Paul, yeah. Boston.
I would put Nashville as number.
I was gonna say Nashville is right there. No, Nashville. 2000. Nashville in 2000. Not Nashville. Well, Nashville's too big.
A few more coffee places. Because that's where I went. I mean, in some ways, I kind of grew up in Nashville.
Yeah,
because my dad was from there.
Right,
and I went to Vanderbilt. So Nashville was always my other city growing up, but I had very complicated feelings. My grandparents, delightful people that they were, would call me their Yankee granddaughter. So I was never really like allowed for Nashville and Tennessee to be my place by them, even though like I felt very at home there. I always had like a sticky relationship with it. Vanderbilt was mine because they didn't really care about that. And my dad went there too. So I guess it was ours, and it's a complicated relationship. So I put it beneath the cities that truly support me.
This is what I love. We're here to talk about a movie about John Cusack, but now we're getting into families and regionalism. So because that's exactly what happens on this pod.
Well, speaking of Chicago though. Okay. I have not yet filled out the John Cusack weirdness.
Okay. Go for it.
Okay. And it has to do with Chicago because, so I talked about how he was like my ultimate teenage crush. It's all John Cusack. I go to college and very early meet this guy from Iowa, whose number one city is Chicago. His family was Irish Chicago, Oak Park eventually. That's where Connor, my husband's family, came to when they came to the U.S. They were mostly Chicago and then moved out to Iowa. Family lore has it that the Cusack's grandmother was either his great-grandmother's best friend or sister. So I may have married a relation of the Cusack's.
I'm in. That's good enough. Listen, if we were doing this as a historical thing, we would say, and this archive were old enough, we're like, chances are there were some relationships between them. And one might example. Yeah, absolutely. No,
I have not yet gone down the ancestry rabbit hole, which I could do. But I so do not want to destroy this beautiful mythology that I have built in my head and find out the actual like document truth, because it's just so magical. Like I literally, you know, so I was like watching the film and like Joan comes up and I hold the phone up next to my husband. I'm like, and he's like, related? Could be.
Don't let facts get in the way of a good story, right? I mean, that's how we that's what UNC Press would say. No, I'm just kidding, guys. So thank you for all
everything
the books.
Everything is footnoted in the book. Luckily, the mythology does not need to be a solid basis for my book. But it's a beautiful story.
Okay, so I want to jump into this. So much of this film is based on top fives. Rob is constantly giving us the top five this, top five that, blah, blah, blah. Who's your favorite of Rob's ex-girlfriends? Or least favorite? I have a least favorite.
You have a least favorite?
Oh, yeah.
Let's see. All right. Catherine Zeta-Jones is so hateful.
Thank you. She's and awful on the TV. Like, I think she's great so at all good, stuff. Though. She's great.
I think
great
she's my favorite, though. Really? I think she's my favorite of the ex-girlfriends because she does that girl like so well. I mean, I sort of have a problem with the way that the women are in this
portrayed
movie.
Yeah, they're objects. Rob sees them as objects to be collected, marked off, conquered, right?
Yes, there's that. And then like none of them, I mean, at least Laura has the relationship with Joan Cusack's character, right? They've got the friend, but other than that, like the women are sort of disconnected, like they don't have other relationships, you know, they're just completely kind of out there free floating. None of them are the kind of, well, except for Sarah Gilbert, who shows up and he's talking about the stiff little fingers and they have that like moment, right? There's like that one. I was like, oh, there's me, right? That's a woman I can relate to in this movie. And, you know, and she gets like half a line.
Yeah. I mean, the women are objects. This film is obviously shot very much from Rob's perspective with Laura as like the great pushback. Who's like, not only am I breaking up with you, I'm breaking up with you because you're an asshole, and I'm going to go be with, with this other guy. Oh my gosh. Do we have to talk about Tim Robbins being completely weird in this movie?
He's so perfect, though. He's so perfect.
With the love scene in Rob's head. Like how, and this is a thing that happens, right? When breakups happen, you can't help it. I don't know if this has happened or not, but like, so many times you envision your former paramour with somebody else. And it's just like, I don't know why we put ourselves through the mental heartache of that. Rob is completely fixated on Laura as his. So the idea that she's with Ian.
Ian.
Oh my God, Ian.
Ray.
Oh my gosh.
I did a little research.
Okay.
And I saw some video. I don't know if this is true or not, that said that Tim Robbins did this role. He accepted this role because he heard that they would make that wig for him.
I read the same thing.
And he got to keep it.
Yeah, he wears it for Halloween.
So good. So good.
He's so weird. Can I talk about one of my favorite scenes in this film, which is like when Cusack is fantasizing about how Robbins is coming into the record store and then they just beat the shit out of him.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's so much fun.
Is this over? No. That's my favorite scene. And then the phone version. Yeah. With the teeth flying out.
Oh my gosh. Right. We're talking about Cusack though. Here's another thing. I, in my mind, Cusack's going through a bit of a moment in time. If we can do the history behind this, he's got this, and I'm always tied this film to Gross Point Blank. In my mind's eye, the two are almost related because they come out right about the same time, although his character is much more relatable. Yeah, he's the assassin with a heart. Dan Aykroyd's so weird in that movie, right? Are there other parts of this film that you like? I want to talk about the stuff that you really enjoy, especially if it's just your own personal enjoyment or if it, as it relates to your work. What do you really dig on this film?
I like that there's so many small details in this movie that I found so relatable. Just like the little asides and the commentary, like from the background and the different kind of asides for me, like, and you know, there's like the big funny moments and, you know, Jack Black just makes this movie for me.
I think he wins this movie. Yeah.
Yeah. A 1,000%. Like, but for me, it's more of the snide remarks that I found so the most
Rob's relatable. Mom giving him shit about breaking up. You break up and then I don't get a grandbaby. Like, they leave, you stay. No kid.
This is stink, Mom. God. Yeah, and I think, I mean, there's like Charlie's, like when he figures out who Charlie really is and that she's awful.
Yeah.
Right? Like the whole setup of that scene and the way that he just throws in a reference to class. He's like, I'm not like a class warrior, but he's able to kind of like pinprick a little point in there that like oh, okay. Like they're acknowledging, they know. Or like, for example, Dick's way of describing things as combinations of like such and such. And so like when he describes Lisa Bonet's the musician character as she's a cross between, I forget what the first one is, but with like a Susan Day, like post Partridge Family, but black. Like,
like but black. Marie de Sade.
You know, but that's the way, sort of the way he relates to the world is like through these comparisons that like nobody would ever come up with.
Speaking of Lisa Bonet, would she and Rob ever really hook up?
No.
You don't think so?
What? No. The whole idea of her like looking across that venue and like, oh, you buddy.
That's the guy. Like, I mean, she's just.
You're the one I relate to.
I believe she is, in the words of my friend Lindsay Travinsky, a smoke show. Am I using that? They use that to describe men, but can women also be smoke shows? I don't know.
Sure, why not?
Okay, Lisa Bonet is like the smokiest of all the smokes. She is like, she's a fucking forest fire in this film. She is just, goddamn. And there's a great irony that like, that Jack Black is giving Rob shit over his Cosby sweater. And then you've got, Lisa who was on Cosby, right? And here's my thought. I'm thinking maybe she does because she's clearly just like, she has the one night stand with him. She's like, yeah, that's what I do. She's just super in charge of her own sexuality. Just like, this is who I am. I'm cool with the fling. Like, I'll try this on for a night. I mean.
But she sensed the rebound, right?
She's smart
enough to be like, all right, that guy's where I'm at. And so, you know, this is not going anywhere, but at least
We had the thing. We had the one night, right? And sometimes the one night is okay, right? When two people go into it and like, this is what this is. It's fine. It's two ships passing.
I just remember, in the night, I remember like, watching this movie and just being so mad at him for going there. I'm like, clearly.
With her?
Laura is, yeah. And I was like, clearly, Laura, you are not over Laura.
No, he's clearly.
Clearly she's what you want. And you need to like, stay the course, man. Like, fix your
Is he supposed to stay the course and get her back, or is he supposed to let her go? Right? Because there's this question of should you stay and fight when she's like, I'm out, and win her back? And this is the bullshit that films do to you that don't respond, that don't work well in real life. Because you're like, I could stay and fight, I'll message her back. That's called stalking. You know, it's like, leave her alone. You know, it's like, do you have to work your shit out before you move on to a new before you move on to a new relationship, or is the new relationship part of the working the shit out? Like, I don't know. I don't understand people, which is awesome because I write about people for a living. So
I read that moment as not him figuring out what was right for him. And like, because I think I felt that that was putting that he would be using her in a way that, like, I wanted to like the character. And so if I saw him as like using this other person in that way, it would kind of enter into new territory for me.
I think that Marie's character is strong enough where she can't be used, because she kind of goes into this knowing exactly what it is, right?
Yeah, she knew what she was doing too. So, but as my, how old was I? 20-year-old self, 21-year-old self.
Yes.
That I remember being like, what is he doing? Because he had already screwed up with Laura by cheating on her.
Right.
And so I was like, so that's what you're going to do? You're just going to like go find more women? Like, what? Like it did not.
Are you really hurting that much if you're hopping in bed with somebody else?
Yeah. Yeah.
But, or is hopping in bed with somebody because we hear the adage, right? The best way to get over somebody is that it's like, where's the fucking duality? Where's the truth in all of this shit? I guess really the idea is like, it's just complicated, right? And this guy is, he's a fucking mess without Laura. I mean, that's the one thing we see is that she's like the stabilizing point in his life. She can't deal with him just being a mess. And she leaves. I mean, I think she's the best character. She may be the best character in this entire thing. She's honest about who she is. I mean, Dick and Barry are great too. But between, it's like, I'm like, does Rob deserve Laura?
Well, and I think that it was about him changing his expectations, right? Because he's always seeking like the flash, you know, getting the girl on stage, the star.
He starts to do that towards the end. I'm going to make a mixtape. Right?
And it's like,
I write down his whole bullshit. Right.
Yeah. Remember, he has this moment earlier where he's talking about like, wouldn't it be great to like be with a musician? And they're like working on their songs, like, and you get to like have a say in that. But what really matters is the everyday and the person that feels like home and the daily comforts. Like, that's the thing that you opt for, not the like flash and the fame and the excitement, right? That was what he kept, right? He was always waiting for the next thing, always waiting for the next exciting payoff and never committing. He was always keeping his options open. And so finally he realized that he had all of the things he actually needed.
Yeah.
With right Laura. Yeah. But doesn't look the like, you know, whoa, like Hollywood fireworks.
No, right? Okay. So I think that's a very genuine thing that humans go through in their own relationships, which is why I continue to come back to this film, because you actually do see him finally mature in this film. Like, there is an actual redemptive arc when he gets it and then finally embraces it, right? And I think that, you know, for historians, there's an aspect of this. And for those of you who are listening who are not professors or anything like that, there's a bit in your career where you're kind of always going to go, I made it to this school. I got a job here, but can I get to the R1 or the Big Ten school or the Ivy or whatever? There's always this thing of like the sexier school or the more prestigious journal or the better press to publish in. Mm-hmm. And there's, I think also in relationships, John Cusack, when this film is released, is 34. So he's about 32, 33 when they're making this film. And I think there's a real natural part to human relationships, which is why I think he's forgivable for this, for his follies early on, because I think there's a natural thing. And we're sold on this idea of this romantic love and sex and stuff like that. And the reality is, you know, romance isn't always the jetting off to Spain and then the fancy dinners and shit. Like, you know what romance is? It's doing the laundry.
Yes.
You know what it is? It's taking the kids to school. It is making sure that that it's washing the car. It is the just fucking, it is the daily process of being there.
Mm-hmm. Cracking my toes while we're watching TV.
That's the shit. That's the good shit. But you know what? It takes a lot. That's the maturation part of a human relationships, right? Where, you know, you have to be, a lot of times you're going to have to be in relationships where you grow and finally get to that point where you accept that and go, wait a second.
Right. Well, and that's why, even though I hate the scene in the movie when her father dies, that's the moment of recognition of like, who's the person that you want there for you when you have to go through life's shit?
She's clearly rooting for him to get there.
Yeah.
You know, I think the part of it's like he broke her heart by not being able to quite get to where she needed him to be.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But when her dad dies, he's the only person she wants. She doesn't call Tim Robbins. You know, first of all, how would he even fit in a car? Tim Robbins is 7 feet, 19 inches tall. He's so, I don't even know how they put him in top. Do you know he's in Top Gun?
Really?
Tim Robbins is Merlin. Oh, he's in the first scene. He's in the back with Cougar. He's the guy with Cougar, and then he's the guy that shows up after Goose dies to ride with Top Gun, with Tom Cruise. Tim Robbins.
All right, well, now I need to go rewatch Top Gun because I did not pick up on that. I was too busy distracted by Val Kilmer. Yeah.
Oh, do we have to do a Val Kilmer film for you too? Does this movie change? Oh, now you're gonna. You know what? I know what movie we have to do for you.
What's that?
It's the college movie with Val Kilmer with the super smart kids. I can't remember the name of it right now. I'm just look it up. So somebody else is screaming this at the top of their lungs right now, where they fill a room full of popcorn and shit like that. Okay, I got to talk about one last thing before we talk about things you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Black. Let's get it on.
So good.
It's fucking great, is it not?
It's so good. It's so good. Okay. I will slip in something that I do not like.
All right.
Which is that is the most full record release party for a first album that I've ever seen, like on a local independent label. I mean, maybe I'm just going to the wrong record releases. But I'm like, that is a whole party that was happening there.
Speaking of which, okay, we'll come back to Jack Black in a second. Did that band not kind of remind you of like a pre-Linkin Park, Linkin Park, those two guys?
Okay, I'm a music nerd for a second. They reminded me of this band called XBXRX, which is still the greatest show that I've ever been to because it was at Springwater in Nashville, which is this little tiny dive bar still there right next to Centennial Park. And back in the time, this would have been 2000, so contemporary, they had these shiny pink streamers that were on the back of behind the band, mm-hmm. where the band would play. And these guys came out and just like fucking screamed like, wow, but it was like a hardcore band, but it was like that noisy kind of quality that band has of like little kid voices. And then they ran around the crowd and just like sprayed everybody with silly string. Like it was unreal. Like I have some of their stuff like on Spotify, but I have not looked to see what happened to them. So somebody will have to Wikipedia that later. But that band reminded me of XBXRX.
All right. I want to go back to Jack Black because this is clearly my favorite part in the entire film.
Yes.
I think Jack Black, when he sings, a lot of times it's kind of goofy and silly. And he does that a little bit in this part here. But there's this moment when he starts to singing and everybody turns around and they're like, holy shit.
First, I have to introduce a band. So please don't leave until after they finish and we play the record. Right now, it's my great, great pleasure to introduce Sonic Death Monkey. Played the whole album first. These people are gonna run the place down.
It's gonna be fun. It's gonna be fun.
Thank you. You're too kind. Rob, thank you for the enthusiastic intro, but we're no longer called Sonic Death Monkey. We're on the verge of being called Kathleen Turner Overdrive. However, this evening we will be Barry Jive and the Uptown Five. For so long, and if you feel like I feel, shit, come on, wow, come on, whoa, let's get it on.
Well, there are other parts that you don't like about this movie.
So one is a contextual dislike, because it reminded me. So I watched this movie with my parents. Because I wanted them, I don't know. I was 21, right? Okay. We're just going to throw logic out the window. And I just thought it was so funny, right? And like, because of the way that it like captures and takes down music nerds all at once, does all of those things. And this was such a huge part of my life that I wanted my parents to like appreciate that. And they did. They thought it was hilarious, except for the scene after her dad dies and they have sex in the car. And I was like, this is weird. Who? What? No. And I'm like with my parents, and it reminded me. Okay, and your listeners will have to send in. And I did. I had a slightly viral tweet one time relating the story of the most awkward movie moments you've ever had. And mine, hands down, is being 13 years old and watching The Piano with my grandmother.
Weird.
like Harvey Keitel.
All of
Harvey Keitel. My poor grandmother says, like, I thought this was a different kind of movie.
There's little Harvey. Or is he little Harvey? Because Jesus Christ. Good for you.
I'm like scarred for life. Scarred for life.
Is like, Harvey Keitel a smoke show?
Not to a 13-year-old girl.
Okay, thank you for clarifying. That's going to have to get edited out because holy shit, thanks for making it weird, Kate. Like, I tend to think that this pod is not from the perspective of the 13-year-old girls, but awesome now that we're on some watch lists. Cool.
All right,
let me ask you this. Do you have a favorite quote from this film?
Oh, yeah, I wrote it down. Okay. My friends and I decided that what matters is what you like, not what you are like.
Works.
That is the Gen X condition right there.
I like it.
Because Gen X totally saturated in popular culture where we could sit and have an entire conversation and truly understand who each other are by what television shows we watched after school in ninth grade.
True that.
Two back-to-back reruns of The Love Boat. I've even seen the special where they go to China.
I don't think I've ever made it through The Love Boat.
See? But you understand things about me now.
I understand that you're a 13-year-old girl at heart, and sometimes you bring that out at weird places, but that's cool. I hope everyone reads your book.
I was just rattling around in your head. I can see it. It's like ding, 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 ding.
I haven't started drinking yet, but there's a wine cabinet just to my right, and it's about to get raided in a little bit. All right. We just asked you for your favorite quote. What? Okay. Mm-hmm. You're an archivist. You're going back. You're looking at this film in the archive. What is the most historic scene from this film?
Is that Peter fucking Frampton?
Is that Peter fucking Frampton?
That is the line that I remember from that film. Not having seen the movie in 20 years, I was like, oh, and I mentioned it to Connor. He's like, is that Peter fucking Frampton? There's reasons. There are real solid historical reasons, not just pop culture snark.
Are we sure that Barry doesn't end up as Jack Black's character in School of Rock? As he matures a bit, it's fun. We should do that movie at some point in time, too.
I love that movie so much. And if you noticed back at the USIH conference, I took a picture of Jack Black's character teaching the Rock and Roll History Board, which I still need like a full scale picture of because it's a fun genius. Like whoever did that.
What was the diagram and all that stuff?
Yeah, the diagram and like the flow chart of rock and roll.
Of influences and stuff? Oh, it's actually brilliant. No, it's someone like did some work on that because it makes sense, right? You're like, you could like see it, you could trace it out and stuff like that.
Yeah, because I paused it and I was like checking it, like, you know, music nerd that I am. The Peter Frampton quote is important because remember how I was talking about the doldrums of the music industry in the late 1970s and their emphasis on kind of the superstars who would appeal the most broadly? Bruce Shulman writes in his book on the 70s about how Peter Frampton basically was the embodiment of that trend. Of his music was the song that was supposed to appeal to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And it somehow becomes popular, but it's like the most like watered down kind of like soul.
Peter Frampton is the Luke Bryan. Yes. Of like the 1970s, right? Isn't that the guy that's like, I got my red truck pick. I'm like, that bullshit, like in that bro country horse shit that's all being created by an algorithm. It's fucking awful. Yeah.
Yes.
Is that Peter Frampton?
Yeah. I meant to go look up the quote from Bruce's book because he's just brutal. And, you know, I've seen students because he gives a lecture version of that in his class. And I've seen students get like very angry about his dislike of Peter Frampton. But I 100% get what he's saying, because it was that like the watering down of the mainstream to satisfy everyone, so you satisfy no one. And so here's these guys who are the product of this underground music scene that was a total revolt from the Peter Framptonization of American popular culture. And now they're going, fuck, this is good. Like, what did she do?
Rob.
What?
Yeah. I always hated that song.
Yeah.
Not gonna like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it takes the whole logic. It takes that whole music snobdom. And on the one hand, absolves them from it, while also completely eviscerating that identity and that need to kind of stake out that position in the pop culture wars.
Look, we've seen the film. If you sing anything and you look like Lisa Bonet, singing the way she does in that movie, which at that point in time, Lisa Bonet for a moment was maybe the most gorgeous woman in recorded history and also all of unrecorded, like... Now I'm having a moment. Goddamn.
A cover of that song, though, did make it into Reality Bites, another Gen X mass market version.
Oh, my God. Fucking Reality Bites.
We can even go deeper.
Oh, by Big Mountain. Oh, I remember that. Actually, that's not a bad cover. I have issues with Reality Bites because no one in that film is likable. It's like you took John Cusack in that movie and just made every character John Cusack, because everyone, especially Ethan Hawke, Ethan Hawke's Troy is a dirtbag piece of shit in that film. I hate him. And Winona Ryder, who I was madly in love with, is so self-absorbed and terrible. Everyone in that, except for maybe Steve Zahn, is awful in that film.
Although I still use the definition of irony that I got from Ethan Hawke's character in that film.
Jesus.
Because that's the only thing, she can't define irony. And he's like...
It was a good soundtrack. And I do want to talk to you about this, right? It was... Reality Bites is a good soundtrack, especially that song "World" by World Party that you cannot find anywhere else. When I come back to you, great. Do you know the song?
I had the Reality Bites soundtrack was one of my first CDs that I purchased.
Oh yeah, it's right in line. And there was this real weird thing between singles and Reality Bites. You were either in one camp or the other, and I'm Team Singles. It's my second favorite film of all time. And I was talking to
I did love Reality today. Bites, but I was also, I was 14 when that came out, 14, 15. So I
it's
was
like stamped characters out of a stereotype.
Yes. But I was that late Xenial, and that was like the mass market Gen X version. And I was like, oh yeah, like that looks like the people that I've been like idolizing. Sure. Like, I'm 15. I have no idea, right?
They all smoked. They smelled terrible.
Yeah. They don't wear a bra. I remember that. I was like, that's going to hurt. Like,
did they not? Like, I don't. Okay. Okay. We'll kind of have you back for the Reality Bites thing. And we'll just make it awkward as fuck. All right. So much of this film is dedicated to great music. Do you have, what's your top five favorite soundtracks of all time? I didn't prep you on this because I wanted you to be able to have to pull it off the top of your head. Top five favorite soundtracks.
Okay. I mean, this is up there. This soundtrack is so
it's
amazing.
Very good. It's really good.
I mean, yeah. I mean, they've question.
Maybe one of the best parts is where he talks about creating a playlist, because you start high and then you got to go higher and then you got to bring it down. Mm-hmm. Like, I think about that. I mean,
that was the science. Oh, my mixtape.
It's so smart. It nailed it.
Such a good mixtape game.
Oh. When was the last time you made a mixtape for someone or a playlist now?
Okay. Well, I haven't made one for anyone. I do have three playlists for the book.
Oh, really?
They are all over 25 hours long. They're all drawn from the archives of College Radio.
Can we share these when we do when we release this pod?
Absolutely.
Okay, we're going to do that.
Number three is still work in progress. But it's like 27 hours long, so there's plenty of stuff on there. It's not representative of College Radio because it is from the archives, and the archives are not complete. But at least gives you an idea. But soundtracks, oh, this is hard. I don't know All right. Well, the Reality Bites soundtrack was also extremely foundational for me because for CD, the Dazed.
You give me top three if you want.
Dazed and Confused, which another playlist. My brother actually went through all of it because I gave being the good. My brother is almost 8 years younger than I am. And so
he's a true millennial.
True millennial. We are different generations.
Fucking gross.
For his 14th birthday, I gave him a copy of Clerks and Dazed and Confused.
He had no idea what that was. Lost on him.
I had no idea.
Lost.
But these are foundational texts for him. And especially Dazed and Confused, who also Wiley Wiggins in that film was another like.
Oh my God. There was a guy I went to high school with named David Jones. We saw that movie and I swear to God, David Jones like morphed into Wiley Wiggins. Did the hair shit where he was constantly doing the shit with his hair and he grew annoying as shit. Oh, yeah. It's awful.
My high school experience was the nerds in the station wagon.
I love those guys.
Yeah. I just want to dance. That was my friend. That was my scene right there.
The guy that gets his ass kicked. You're not good on him though. At least he stood up.
Anthony Rapp's character. I actually met Anthony Rapp when I was in college.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he was great. He hosted a drag show at Vanderbilt when I was there. And nice. we all got to hang out afterwards. And he was lovely, extremely lovely person. So it was like one of those teenage moments of like, oh, like you were that character in the car that seemed like my friends. And I'm like hanging out with you. So that was
right. Cool. He's like, that was my job.
Yes. But anyways, my brother.
Yes.
Went through the Dazed and Confused and made the extended Dazed and Confused playlist on Spotify.
Okay.
No, it is excellent.
All right. So we got Dazed and Confused. We've got Reality Bites. And then what else you got? Give me one more.
I mean, this movie is so important, but I need to get another one. Oof.
You know, I think about Pure Country with George Strait. Do you remember that coming out? Like that was like a thing for a short time. He had a beard. He still has a hat.
All right. And I will say because I lived in such a radio starved world, the Forrest Gump soundtrack was actually really
important. I was thinking that. It was actually outstanding. It was like we could talk about Forrest Gump all day long, not on this pod, but it's just like it's the soundtrack just from, I mean, they really narrate that time as well. And I also set up the rule that you cannot in a history class talk about Vietnam without playing Fortunate Son. It is. Yeah. Against the rules of history. So,
I mean, that was so to get a little real. My uncle, he married my mom's sister. My uncle Bill was, he went into the army at 18 in 1967. And eventually he was a sergeant in the army in the Central Highlands during Tet. He has a bronze and a silver star and two purple hearts.
Oh, wow.
And real shit. And, I did a very long oral history with him, which was really difficult to do. Some stuff he wouldn't tell me because I was his niece.
Yep.
But when he passed away, complications of Agent Orange exposure, Fortunate Son was what I played before I went into his funeral. It encapsulates like that sound and that experience, that like image, the images that that song puts in my head, probably associated with Forrest Gump. Like help me like think about like when that movie came out, because I was not watching, you know, Platoon or anything like that. It was Forrest Gump that helped me kind of understand what my Uncle Bill and I was very close to my aunt too, and still am. And so that movie was really important.
All right. Well, give me this. Let's pull this all the way back to your book. Something might be a little bit more off the top of your head then. Give me your top five most important college radio stations or like universities with college radios Five that come to mind that we should know about.
All right. That are musically and politically, or just kind of like typify college radio.
Whatever you want. Give us five.
Okay. Well, WBAU at Adelphi University, I have an entire chapter as the last chapter in the book. It no longer exists because the university president sold it, got rid of it, because he did not consider hip hop to be worthy of inclusion in the academy. That station is where Public Enemy formed.
Holy fucking shit. Are you
sure? WBAU is a storied station, despite no longer existing. And the students that tried to save it are the heroes in the book. Like, if there's a lot of like kind of, you know, Rob type characters in the book, who you're not quite sure how to feel about. And that is human. That is everyone. There's one Absolutely. Hero in this book, and her name is Jackie Parker. And she was an undergraduate at Adelphi when they were still selling the station. And she was like a one woman mission to save the station. And unfortunately she fails, but she's so amazing in trying to save it. So, deep place in my heart for WBAU on Long Island. WRVU, of course, also no longer on the air, which is my alma mater. So you can't make a list like that and not say it.
No. But
my local radio station that I listen to all the time is WMBR at MIT. A very strong community-oriented station. It used to be WTBS until Ted Turner bought its letters.
God, I feel like this book is just nothing but a bunch of like oh my god, it's like getting kicked in the shins at some of these stories.
All right, if I'm gonna pick two more, I have so many favorites, so this is purely an archive thing. Rice University Station, also sold their DJ books. And the DJ books at WUOG in Athens at the University of Georgia, they're where students write back and forth. It sits in the studio, so kind of pre-email chains, and they would just write notes back and forth. I mean, huge fights about music and what is our station, and they're unbelievable. Most of them disappear, but some do make it into the archives. Some are still in stations. MIT's is still in their station, and it runs straight from 1978 to about 2006.
I can only imagine Athens. Think about all the music that's come out of that little town.
Yes.
Like, we've got this small group that's at least Michael Stipe. Right? It's like,
yeah, no big deal.
they'll never make it. So,
yeah.
All right. Let me ask you. Here's our final question here.
Okay.
Kate Jewell, is High Fidelity a history film?
Yes, because it captures a particular generational or conception of a generational identity and experience and figure, and a particular, I guess, kind of moment in the music industry and the revolt from a certain conception of musical power that is dictated by elites. It was a sort of kind of democratic sort of underground that people were really trying to use to cultivate community and belonging in local spaces that we're still very much trying to do, but has become a lot more complicated.
What station can people find you on? Online, where can people find? I tried to do it. It didn't fucking work. Where can people find you on Twitter, elsewhere, social media? Where can people find out more about you and the book?
Well, katherinejewell.com is my website that has all of the relevant links and news about.
Did you put the playlists on the website?
The playlists, I think, are there. They're on my link tree, which you can find linked on all of my socials. Kate Jewell at, what is it, Threads and Instagram. It's Katis Jewell on Twitter, Katis Jewell, which was my nickname in middle school. And it's stuck on my Twitter handle.
Are you on Blue Sky yet?
I am on Blue Sky. I think I'm also Kate Jewell there.
I'm liking the conversations I'm having on Blue Sky. It feels better. It
feels natural. And I met another Blue Skyer this morning. Ian Petrie and I met up in Philadelphia and had breakfast this morning.
Oh, terrific.
So, you know, like historians meeting in real life. It's always amazing. Yeah, Kate Jewell at Blue Sky.
Well, Kate Jewell, Blue Sky, this is Jason Herbert. We are signing off from WHATM. Right? That's so fucking weak. I'm trying so hard. Either, you know, thank you so much for being here. I had a blast talking to you today. So this was
thank
awesome.
Thank you. It was very fun. Thank you.
And that's a wrap here at Historians of the Movies podcast. Thank you so much to our guest today, Kate Jewell. Kate, you were awesome. That was such a fun conversation. I absolutely love hanging out with you every single chance that I get. Thank you, of course, to our man in the booth, our producer, Fletcher Powell, for making this show run. Thank you so much for being here, Fletch. And, of course, thank you to you guys for being part of this podcast. Thank you for continuing to share it. Your enthusiasm for this podcast, for the HATM community, just blows me away. So thank you so much for being here. This was a fun day, a fun podcast, and I'm so glad you were here for it. So that said, I'll catch you guys next time. Ciao for now.